Geekscape.com.
White supremacy and Negro subordination, part 4. The human creation, part 2. There is a seemingly predetermined design of some to make an issue on this matter, to appeal to a supposed popular bigotry and fanaticism in order to conceal the most vital and most stupendous truth of modern times, a truth underlying all our sectional difficulties, and which, truly apprehended by the mind of the masses, will instantly explode those difficulties, renders it an imperative duty to expose the folly and the sophistry of those who strive to keep it out of sight. They assume that the Bible teaches the origin of all mankind from a single pair, that the Mongol, the Indian, the Negro, with the same origin, have the same nature as the white man, and consequently have the same natural rights, and that we owe to them the same duties that we owe to ourselves or to our own race. And moreover, they proclaim a belief in this assumption as essential to salvation, or in other words, that if it be rejected, Christianity will disappear from the world. It need not be repeated that the writer will not condescend to argue a self-evident, actually existing, every day palpable and unavoidable physical fact, or insult the reader's understanding by presenting proofs to show that the Negro is specifically different from himself. That is a matter beyond the province of rational discussion, and entirely within the domain of the senses. Yet, as already observed in the subsequent chapters of this work, the extent of these differences separating whites and blacks will be demonstrated, their physical differences and approximations shown, in order to determine their moral relations and social adaptations. But the assumption that belief in the dogma of a single human race or species is vital to the preservation of Christianity needs to be exposed, as it is in reality as monstrous in morals as stupid and absurd in fact. We cannot believe that which we know to be untrue, and to affect such belief, however good the motive may seem, must necessarily debauch and demoralize the whole moral structure. There are many things, such as the belief in the doctrine of election, original sin, of justification by faith, that admit of belief, honest, earnest, undoubting belief, for they are abstractions and purely matters of faith that can never be brought to the test of physical demonstration or to the standard of material fact. But the question of race, the fact of distinct races, or rather the existence of species, of Caucasian, Mongols and Negroes, are physical facts, subject to the senses, and it is beyond the control of the will to refuse assent to their actual presence. Can a man, by taking thought, add a cubit to his stature? Can he believe himself something else, a woman, a dog, or that he does not even exist? That black is white, or that red is yellow, or that the Negro is a white man? It is possible to deceive and delude ourselves and believe or think that we believe many things which our interest, our prejudices and our caprices prompt us to believe, but they must be things of an abstract nature, where there are no physical tests to embarrass us or compel the will to bow to that fixed and immutable standard of truth which the Eternal has planted in the very heart of things, and which otherwise the laws of the mental organism absolutely force us to recognize. But the existence of distinct species of men does not belong to this category. It is fact, a palpable, immediate, demonstrable, and unescapable fact. We know, and we cannot avoid knowing, that the Negro is a Negro and is not a white man, and therefore we cannot believe, however much we may strive to do so, that he is the same being that we are, or in other words, that all mankind constitute a single race or species. All that is possible or permissible is to make liars and hypocrites of ourselves, to pretend to believe in a thing that we do not and cannot believe in, to force this hypocrisy and pretended belief on others who may happen to have confidence in our honesty and respect for our ability, and finally, as a salve for our outraged conscience, to deceive ourselves with the notion that our motives are good and that the end justifies the means. But the advocates of the European theory of a single race are faced by other difficulties, which are quite as unavoidable as those thus briefly glanced at. They demand that the world shall believe in the dogma of a single race, but not one among them will act upon it in practice or convince others of their sincerity by living up to their avowed belief. If the Negro had descended from the same parentage, or, except in colour merely, was the same being as ourselves, then there could be no reason for refusing to amalgamate with him, as with the several branches of our race. But on the contrary, the reverend and distinguished gentleman, who has ventured to declare that the belief that the Negro is a being like ourselves is essential to Christianity, would infinitely prefer the death of his daughter to that of marriage with the most accomplished and most pious Negro in existence. If he believed in his own assertions in regard to this matter, then it would be his first and most imperative duty, as a Christian minister, to set an example to others, to labour night and day, to elevate this, in that case, wronged and outraged race. Indeed, to suffer every personal inconvenience, even martyrdom itself, in the performance of a duty so obvious and necessary. And when this theory was at last reduced to practice, and all the existing distinctions and prejudices against the Negro were obliterated, and the 4 millions of Negroes amalgamated with the whites, society would be rewarded by the increased morality and purity that would follow an act of such transcendent justice. But will anyone believe in such a result, that reducing to practice the belief or pretended belief of a single race will or would benefit American society? No. Indeed, on the contrary, everyone knows, even the wildest and most perverted abolitionist knows, that to reduce this dogma to practice, to honestly live out this pretended belief, to affiliate with these Negroes, would result in the absolute destruction of American society. Nothing, therefore, can be more certain than the hypocrisy of those who pretend to believe in this single race doctrine, for it need not be repeated that they do not and cannot believe in it in reality. But why should they deem this absurd doctrine essential to their interpretation of the Bible? That the Almighty Creator subsequently changed the order of the human creation is in entire harmony with the universally received history of the Christian revelation. All the Christian sects of the day admit the doctrine of miracles or supernatural interposition, down to the time of the apostles, and the largest of all, the Roman Catholics, credit this interposition at the present day, and therefore those ready to recognize it in such numerous instances, many too of relatively trifling importance, but determined to reject it in this matter of races, are only imitating their brethren of old, and straining at gnats while swallowing camels with the greatest ease. To many persons, the great doctrines of the Christian faith carry with them innate and irresistible proof of their divine origin. But the professional teachers of theology depend mainly upon supernatural interposition to convince the world of its truth. And yet, by a strange and unaccountable perversity, some of them would reject it in the most important, or at all events, one of the most important instances in which it ever did or ever could occur. But will the sensible and really conscientious Christian priest or layman venture to persist in forcing this assumption, this palpable, demonstrable, unmistakable falsehood that the single race dogma is essential to the preservation of Christianity upon the public? If he does, and it is accepted by those who look upon him as a teacher, then it is certain that he will inflict infinite mischief on the cause of Christianity. To assume that all mankind have white skins, or straight hair, or any other specific feature of our own race involves no greater absurdity. Indeed, involves the exact absurdity that the assumption of a single human species does. If it were assumed that we must stultify ourselves and believe, or pretend to believe, that all mankind have white skins, or Christianity would be lost to the world, there is not a single man in this republic that would not reject such an assumption with scorn and contempt. White and black are, of course, specialities, but no more so than, as will hereafter be shown, all the other things that constitute the Negro being. And therefore, the assumption put forward, substantially and indeed exactly, is thus. We must believe that whites, Indians, Negroes, etc. have the same colour, or the whole fabric of Christianity will be overthrown and lost to mankind. But enough. All Americans know, for they cannot avoid knowing, that Negroes are Negroes, and specifically different from themselves. They know, moreover, that they differed just as widely when first brought to this continent. And all who understand the simplest laws of organization know that they must always remain thus different from ourselves. And therefore, they know that they were made so by the act and will of the Almighty Creator, while when, or how, or why they are thus is beyond the province of human inquiry and of no manner of importance whatsoever.
You're tuned in to Radio Aryan.
Chapter 4. Historical Outline. The white, or Caucasian, is the only historic race, the race which is alone capable of those mental manifestations which, written or unwritten, leave a permanent impression behind. What was its first or earliest condition upon the earth? This, except the meagre account given by Moses, is unknown, nor is it of much importance that it should be known, for though it never was, nor could be, savage or barbarous, as these terms are understood, in modern times, still its intellectual acquisitions were doubtless so limited that it really known to us they would be of little or no service. Moses scarcely attempts any description of social life before the time of Abraham, and that then presented does not differ very materially from what exists in the same locality at the present day. The pastoral habitudes of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the sale of Joseph to the Ishmaelites by his brethren, his purchase in Egypt and sudden exaltation at the court of the Egyptian monarch is an almost exact counterpart of scenes witnessed now, and with little variation, in the same lands for the last 4,000 years. The starting point, the locality where the race first came into being, is equally hidden as the time or period of its creation. Biblical writers have usually supposed somewhere in Asia Minor, on the banks of the Euphrates, while ethnologists are inclined to believe that the high tablelands of Tibet and Hindu Kush may have been the cradle of the race. Nor is a knowledge of this material, or indeed of the slightest consequence, except as an aid in determining its true centre of existence, that is, its physical adaptation or specific affinities for a certain locality. But this is determined by experience, and it is demonstrated beyond doubt that while the elaborate and relatively perfect structure of the Caucasian man enables him to resist all external agencies and to exist in all climates capable of supporting animal life, he can only till the soil or perform manual labour in the temperate zones. It is therefore immaterial when or where he first came into being, or what was the starting point of the race. Its centre of existence is alike in all the great temperate latitudes of Asia, Africa, Europe, and America. The history of the race may be said to be divided into three great cycles or distinct periods, all, however, connecting with each other, and doubtless many resembling each other in their essential nature, however widely different in their external manifestation. The first period, beginning with its actual existence on the earth, may be said to terminate in the era of authentic history. The second, or historic era, may be assumed as extending to the overthrow of the Roman Empire by the so-called Northern Barbarians, or perhaps to what is usually termed the Dark Ages. Finally, there is another grand cycle in human destiny, which, beginning with the restoration of learning, comes down to and includes our own times. In regard to the first, we actually know little of it, for, leaving out of view the sacred scriptures, we have only a few imperfect glimpses of the actual life of the countless millions that preceded the historic period. What little knowledge we have depends on tradition and mythology. Sometimes, perhaps, true enough, but the greater portion thus transmitted to our times we know is false, because conditions are assumed that are in contradiction with the laws that govern our animal being. If the race, however, was created in Asia, we know that portions of it migrated to Africa at a very remote period. Indeed, leaving the Bible out of view, the first knowledge we have of its existence, or the earliest traces of its existence, is in Africa. Caucasian tribes or communities entered the valley of the Nile, possibly before the delta of the lower country was sufficiently hardened to admit of cultivation, as they evidently occupied localities considerably removed from the outlet of that great river. These early adventurers conquered the aboriginal population, subjected them to their control, compelled them to labour for them, built magnificent cities, temples, palaces, founded a mighty empire, and advanced to a certain extent in civilization. But wealth and luxury, with their effeminate consequences, probably too, injustice and crime in the rulers, and certainly, and worst of all, interunion and affiliation with the conquered races tempted purer and hardier branches of the race to invade them, and indeed the delicious climate and fertile soil must have always tempted Caucasian tribes into the valley of the Nile from the earliest periods, and whenever they felt themselves strong enough to attack the existing community. Of course, we can only deal in conjecture in regards to this matter, but it is probable that numerous invasions took place, each passing through much the same course as its predecessors. First came conquest, then the creation of a mighty empire, followed by a grand civilization. Then came effeminacy, affiliation with the subject races, debauchment and debility, inviting a new conquest by pure Caucasians, and they, in their turn, going through the same round of glory and decay, of conquest and degradation. Such seems to have been the condition of Egypt when the Romans invaded it and made it a province of that great empire. The effect remains of these Egyptian populations afterwards became known to the Roman writers, and to a certain extent may be said still to exist. The great Asiatic empires were doubtless similar to the Egyptian, except in respect to the debauchment of blood. The Assyrians, Persians, Chaldeans, Babylonians, Hebrews, etc., each in their turn, were conquerors and conquered, masters and slaves, but their downfall, in one essential respect, differed widely from those of Africa. They were pure unmixed Caucasians, for at that time the Mongol element was unknown in that portion of Asia, and the Negro, except a few household servants, never existed on that continent. The Mongolian race was first known about 500 years anterior to the Christian era, and whether originally it existed in a more northern region or had not reached a full development as regards numbers cannot be known, on account of our limited knowledge of the earth at that time. The old Caucasian populations of Asia knew nothing of it and had no admixture of Mongolic blood. But all is conjecture, mystery, doubt, and uncertainty in regard to these ancient and extinct empires. We know that they existed, that they were white men, beings like ourselves, our own ancestors, with the same wants, the same instincts, in short, the same nature that we have, and therefore, in the main, acted as we do now. Of course, we call them heathens, pagans, savages, barbarians, etc., but were they thus? In the modern times, there are no white barbarians or heathens. In all modern history, wherever found, white men are much the same. Why then should it not have been so always? The fanatic Jew called all others Gentiles, savages. The supercilious Greek called even their Roman conquerors barbarians. Even the manly and liberal Roman did not rise above this foolish bigotry, and not only called the Gauls, Britons, Germans, etc. barbarians, but reduced them to slavery, as if they were inferior beings. We witness the same ignorance and folly in our own enlightened times. The Englishman believes that the English are alone truly Christian and civilized. The Frenchman honestly believes that La Belle France is at the head of modern civilization. Even the advanced and liberal American Democrat thinks, and perhaps correctly, that the Americans alone are truly civilized, while some among us would exclude all from the privilege of citizenship who happen to be born elsewhere, as rigidly as the Jew did the uncircumcised Gentile, or the Muslim, the dog of a Christian. Is not this notion of outside barbarians, therefore, the result of ignorance or foolish egotism without sense or reason? Some nations or communities were doubtless advanced more than others in ancient times as at present, but in the main, the race must have approximated to the same common standard that we witness now. If it is said that in early times the obstacles in the way of frequent intercourse prevented this general approximation to a common standard of enlightenment, it may be replied that the same obstacle would also prevent a wide departure, and when we know that they had the same wants, the same instincts, the same tendencies, the conclusion seems unavoidable that no nation or community could at any time in history assume, with any justice, that others were barbarians or that they alone were civilized. The traditions and imperfect knowledge which we have hitherto possessed in respect to these long-buried populations may perhaps be replaced by that which is almost or quite as reliable as written history itself. Within a few years past, a class of men have sprung up who, excavating the dead remains of long-forgotten empires, promise revelations that will bring us face to face with the buried generations that we know only through the dim perspective of uncertain tradition. Champollion, Belzoni, Rawlinson, Layard and their companions have already made discoveries in Egypt and Nineveh that open to our minds much of the social conditions and daily life of those remote times, and future explorations, it is probable, will give us nearly as accurate a knowledge as we have of those embraced within the cycle of authentic history. The next great period in the history of the race, the historic era, is supposed to be entirely within the province of real knowledge. It begins with the history of the Greeks, not the symbolic, but the real, that grand and glowing intellectualism, which in many respects may be said to equal the intellectual development of our own times. The history of Greece and Rome is in truth the history of the race, of the world, of mankind. There were contemporary nations of great power, extent, and cultivation, but the Greeks and Romans, and the subject or servile populations that acknowledged their supremacy, made up the larger portion of the race. It is true, the Persians were then pure Caucasians, and in respect to numbers, largely surpassed the Greeks, but while they did not differ much in their general character, they were on the decline before the Greeks had reached their full national development. The latter always referred to Egypt as the source of their civilization, but it is more probable that they borrowed from Asia most of those things supposed to be of foreign origin. It is, however, quite possible that the earliest civilization was developed in Africa, that it receded from thence to Asia, as we know it afterwards did from the latter to Europe, and as we now witness it passing to America. But what is civilization? It is, or it may be defined as, the result of intellectual manifestation. A nation or people who have most deeply studied and understood the laws of nature or the nature of things, and applied their knowledge to their own welfare, are the most civilized. Or we might say, in a word, that the nation that has the most knowledge is the most civilized. The Greeks certainly surpassed all contemporary nations in the most essential of all knowledge, yet even this seems to have been rather a thing of chance than otherwise. Political intelligence, or a knowledge of men's social relations to each other, is the most vital they can possess. The Greeks may be said both to have possessed this knowledge and to have been entirely deficient in it. Athens, with 30,000 citizens, all recognized as political equals, was a democracy. But this so-called democracy, with perhaps 100,000 slaves, was a burlesque on a democratic government. The Helots of Greece, the servile and subject population of which history gives no account, except to refer to them, were white men, men with all the natural capacities of Socrates, Demosthenes, or Alcibiades. But the Greek orators and writers of the day never even seemed to imagine that they had any rights whatsoever. They had much the same relation to the Greeks that the Saxons had to the Normans, that the Irish have to the English, and yet with all their political enlightenment and high intellectual development, the Greeks gave them no rights and treated them as different and subordinate beings. The notion therefore taught in our schools that the Greeks were the authors of political liberty is unsound. They neither practiced nor understood liberty, and the external forms mistaken for democracy had no necessary connection with it. Aristotle could not form even a conception of a political system that did not rest upon slavery, and this was doubtless the general condition of the Greek mind. It was merely accidental that the Greek states assumed a democratic form, or rather approximated to a democratic form, But while they were utterly ignorant of individual relations, they certainly had clear views of the relations of states and the duties that independent communities owe to each other. The Asiatic nations seem to have had no conception whatsoever of these duties. Conquest or slavery were the only alternatives. A nation must conquer or be conquered, a dynasty must destroy all others or expect to fall itself, and the Asiatic character still partakes largely of these habitudes. Except, therefore, in the mere externals or outward arrangements of political society, the Greeks can hardly be said to have done anything for political liberty or to advance political science. The Romans did more, vastly more, but they had little or no conception of democracy or of individual liberty. The proud boast, "I am a Roman citizen," unlike the idea of the American Democrat, partook of the spirit of a British aristocrat of our own days, claiming the privileges of his order. The men who founded the city of Rome, though doubtless filibusters and adventurers, perhaps even outcasts of the neighbouring populations, were assumed to be superior to the later emigrants, and their descendants especially claimed exclusive privileges. And when Rome expanded into a mighty empire and ruled the world, the senatorial order ruled the empire, at all events, until Caesar crossed the Rubicon and seized the supreme power. The change from a republic to an empire had little or no bearing upon the question of liberty, for the condition of the great body of the people remained the same. Rome conquered all, or nearly all, the then known world, for except the Persians, and perhaps some few populations in the far north, the whole Caucasian race recognized the Romans as their rulers. The Parthians, so often waging desperate war with the Romans, were doubtless a mixed people, something like the modern Turks, and very possibly their ancestors. Following the rude code of early times, the Romans enslaved the conquered populations. All the prisoners of war were deemed to have forfeited their lives and were parcelled out among the Roman conquerors, while the rural populations were compelled to pay tribute to the Roman civil officers. It is quite probable that the Romans conquered some of the inferior races, but except the Numidians, Libyans, Ethiopians, etc. of Africa, Roman writers are silent on the subject. It has been said that the history of the Romans was the history of the Caucasian race, and that was the history of the world. This is literally true, for though we cannot suppose that the conquered populations were the miserable barbarians that the Roman writers represent them to have been, Rome was the most advanced portion of the race, and therefore the embodiment of its civilization and intellectual life. At this moment, Paris represents all France, and the city of Rome bore a somewhat similar relation to the populations that composed the empire, however distant they may have been from the capital. It was not an unusual thing for the same general that commanded in Britain, or that had conquered in Gaul, to administer the government of the African provinces, or to conduct a campaign against the Persians on the bank of the Euphrates. And however much the vanity of Roman authors may have been gratified by assuming that they alone were civilized, it is altogether irrational to suppose that the conquered populations, with the same nature and same capacities as themselves, and moreover, in frequent and often intimate intercourse with themselves, could have differed widely or remained barbarians, even if such, when conquered. The Romans advanced far beyond the Greeks in political knowledge, but with them also the state was everything and the individual nothing. As with the Greeks, the great majority were slaves, and Roman citizenship, or the rights claimed by a Roman citizen, was at best a special privilege, and prior to the advent of Christianity, the idea of individual rights, of equality, of democracy, seems never to have dawned upon the intellectual horizon of the race. Nor did the primitive Christians even accept it in theory, though they lived it out in practice. Their mental habits were formed under the old social order, and though the spirit of the new doctrine impelled them to live it out in practice, few, if any, ever adopted it in theory. Christ had said, "Love each other, and do unto others as you would have them do unto you." That is, grant to others the rights claimed for yourselves. But while they often lived together, owning things in common, like the modern communists and socialists, perhaps not one in a million ever thought of applying their doctrine to the state, or even supposing for a moment that the artificial distinctions which separated classes could ever be altered or modified. Even the forced and unnatural relation of master and slave, which necessarily violated the fundamental doctrine of their religion, was clung to and respected in theory, and it needed several centuries of practice and faithful obedience to the spirit of the new faith before this ancient barbarism was finally obliterated from the Roman world. The conquest of Rome by the so-called northern barbarians was followed by an eclipse of learning, by a mental darkness in Western Europe at least, that is, fitly enough, dominated the Dark Ages. Was this eruption of the northern nations into Italy the true cause of this darkness? For several centuries previous, there had been an immense and almost continuous emigration from Asia, not of individuals, as we witness in the present day, to America, but of tribes, communities, whole nations. History is indeed imperfect, if not altogether silent, in respect to the cause of these mighty migrations which so long pressed upon Europe. But there can be little doubt that the Mongolian race about this time changed to a considerable extent its location, and pressing down on the old Caucasian populations of Asia, impelled these vast masses to seek shelter and safety, if not home and happiness, in Europe. In the mighty invasions of Italy, in the 5th century by Attila, the truth of this is certainly demonstrated. He himself was doubtless a white man, and so were his chiefs, but the mighty populations he ruled over, and which extended from the Danube to the frontiers of China, were mainly Mongolian. But no Mongolians settled permanently in Europe, none but Caucasians, and except the modern Turks, none but pure Caucasians, and being the same men as the Romans themselves, why should they be barbarians? They were conquerors, a pretty good proof that, though not so refined perhaps, certainly not so effeminate as the Romans had become, they could not have been barbarians. Other things being equal, the nation that has made the greatest advance in knowledge will be able to conquer, because it has only to apply its knowledge to this object to succeed. There can be no doubt that we ourselves surpass all the nations of our times in knowledge, or in our capacity to apply our knowledge to the purposes of material existence. Our railroads, canals, public works, our shipbuilding, commerce, etc. prove this, and we have only to apply this knowledge to purposes of offence or defence, to invade others or to defend ourselves, to demonstrate our immense superiority. Nevertheless, if we should conquer Spain, or any other ancient and effete empire, doubtless their writers would take their revenge in calling us barbarians, as indeed the poor, feeble, and adulterated hybrids of Mexico actually did thus represent us when in possession of their capital. Nothing, therefore, can be more improbable than the theory of Gibbon and others that the nations that conquered Rome were barbarians and that the Dark Ages were the result of that conquest. But there was a cause for the subsequent darkness, which so long spread over the European world, much more palpable. Christianity had become generally accepted, and bad and ambitious men in the then general ignorance of the masses of the populations, might wield it with stupendous effect in advancing their ambition and securing their own personal objects. The assumption that Christ had delegated a power on earth to interpret the will of heaven, both as to temporal as well as religious interests, was enough. Of course, all human investigation and mental activity terminated and was denounced as impiety. The subordinate clergy were often, perhaps generally, faithful to the great truths transmitted by the primitive Christians, but dependent on tradition and subject to the rule of their sacerdotal superiors. They in vain resisted these influences, and these truths became in time so corrupted as scarcely to retain any resemblance to the original faith. It is believed that, except in these dark ages, the Caucasian mind has never retrograded or indeed remained stationary. Progress is the law, the instinct, the necessity of the Caucasian mind, and however much some branches or some nations may decline, there is always some portion, nationality, or community that embodies the wants of the race, and that moves forward in pursuit of that indefinite perfectibility which is its specific and distinguishing characteristic. But it is easily understood how this might have suffered an eclipse under the circumstances then existing. A great portion of the so-called barbarian conquerors of Rome were ignorant of Christianity, and when they became the converts of the conquered Romans, they naturally exalted their teachers as beings almost superhuman in their superior knowledge, and the general ignorance of the times favoured any pretension of the priests, however absurd it might be. In fact, a body of men claiming to be, and universally believed to be, the interpreters of the will of the Almighty, necessarily interrupted all inquiry into the laws of nature, which are the real laws of God, and so some monks themselves, immured in their cells, continued to think, to experiment, to acquire knowledge, as well as in many instances to preserve that already acquired by others. The great mass of the people, as well as the great body of the clergy, looked upon everything of the kind as wicked, impious, and heretical. And we have only to suppose an intellectual activity and freedom corresponding with our own times throughout these dark centuries to realize the stupendous evil inflicted on the world by this priestly arrogance and ambition.
You're listening to Radio Aryan at Radio Aryan.